It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the show today, three words: critical staffing shortage. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Reis, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, January 10th. Good to have you with us. All right, so let's just get started with what I said. Critical staffing shortages, which are a result of the very fact that, yes, the virus is still in charge of this economy. Looking at the positive case counts, the seven-day average is more than 700,000. And that, of course, doesn't include the people at home getting positive results on their rapid test. All of that is putting a lot of pressure on hospitals, just totally overwhelming the healthcare system. About a fourth of hospitals say they're dealing with serious staffing shortages. And that's largely because more and more healthcare workers are among those getting sick. Marketplace's Samantha Fields gets us going.
Our Lady of the Lake Regional Medical Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, has been at capacity for more than a week.
Which means we are no longer taking transfers, which is our job.
Dr. Catherine O'Neill is chief medical officer at Our Lady of the Lake. She says that's partly because so many staff are either sick with COVID or someone in their family has it.
We have 130 nurses or bedside caregivers out today. That doesn't include people who help us clean rooms and turn them over and get patients in.
Because of that, she says, the hospital has had to temporarily close about 10% of its beds. Dr. Jorge Caballero runs a volunteer organization called Coders Against COVID, and he says there's been a substantial increase recently in the number of hospitals reporting critical staffing shortages. Depending on the hospital, that can mean different things.
Cutting bed capacity, cutting out elective procedures, and trying to get healthcare workers back into the hospital, even if they are COVID positive.
Because there just aren't other options. In Alaska, the Omicron surge is just beginning. And even though hospitalizations aren't rising as fast as they did with Delta so far, shortages are still a problem, says Jared Kosin at the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association.
If we have more staff out, we start hitting those critical levels and have to make maneuvers to provide care.
Like moving healthy staff around and delaying surgeries. Alaska hospitals are also working to build the pipeline of healthcare workers longer term, Kosin says. Just in the last few months, they started a new program to recruit more certified nursing assistants with hiring and retention bonuses.
And we actually changed our training guidelines to allow for faster training.
Already, Kosin says, it's making a difference. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was a kind of gloomy Monday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow is a big day for Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell. He has a reconfirmation hearing on Capitol Hill. He's likely to face some questions about the Fed's plan to raise interest rates in the coming months. And the banking industry is going to be listening very closely. Many financial companies are reporting their fourth quarter earnings later this week. But remember, this is an environment where the Fed wasn't touching interest rates at all. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on what those banks should expect this year.
Make no mistake, banks had a good 2021, but talk of record profits needs to be couched a bit. Jason Ware, Chief Investment Officer at Albion Financial Group, says many banks set aside a lot of money to offset potential loan defaults at the height of the pandemic.
And as the recovery took hold last year, they moved these reserves back over into the profit line of the income statement.
Which he says is standard practice, no funny business, but as a result,
there was a major tailwind last year from these loan loss provisions being moved back over to the income statement that provided a big boom to earnings for banks.
Investors expect the good times to keep rolling for banks in 2022, specifically because yields on the loans that banks are offering could rise as a result of the Fed's monetary policy decisions. But Shiraz Meehan at Zacks Investment Research says these days, a financial institution's profitability depends less and less on the core business, consumer banking, and more on the other things that banks do.
The capital markets, investment banking, mergers and acquisitions, initial public offerings, trading business, all of that is practically firing on all cylinders.
He says banks have historically been conservative when it comes to new areas of potential growth. And while more and more are hiring cryptocurrency managers to test the water there, Ken Leon at CFRA says many will wait for clear regulation before they jump in.
So whether crypto is a currency or how is it defined as an instrument or security, no one's going to put their foot on the pedal in these areas until there's clarity really from Washington.
But he says banks are also cognizant of customers going elsewhere if they can't invest in things like crypto with them. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
You could say 2021 was a historic year for real estate, great for sellers and for people who already had homes, but not so great for buyers as prices reached record highs. But now, if you were among the lucky few who bought in 2020 before the great reshuffling, well, that's pretty fortunate timing. And that takes us to the next installment of our series, Adventures in Housing.
My name is Alex Hendy, and I am a real estate and property management professional in Richmond, Virginia. I started looking to buy a home in 2019 and into 2020. After essentially 3.5 months of looking, we landed on a wonderful house that was $255,000, which was in the middle of the price range that I was looking at, but also terrifying because I've never spent so much money on anything in my life. And now get to experience that the bank owns you feeling. But the pandemic has been a period of financial success for me, which sounds really uncomfortable and unnatural to say. The first piece is that my interest rate dropped over 1% between the month that I was pre-approved and the moment my loan closed. The stimulus money paid for my brand new washer dryer, not to mention the fact that in the ensuing year and a half, the housing market has only continued to get hotter in Richmond because of the pandemic. There had been a dozen or more fortuitous swings my way, not because of anything I per se earned. There are so many other people across this country who would not have had the same opportunity that I did. My parents both have backgrounds in social service, psychology, homeless outreach, etc. I was raised with this idea of understanding what privilege is, and understanding that there's a responsibility to act on that. That when you realize that's where you are, You can't continue to sit by and not do anything about it. So in January of 2021, I started volunteering for a community development organization in Richmond, Virginia that builds and develops communities. This is not only my house, this is my street, this is my community, and I need to be an equal and productive part of that for the rest of my life.
That was Alex Hindy in Richmond, Virginia. We also want to hear about your adventures in housing. You can do that by going over to marketplace.org. Right, so we heard from Samantha earlier about healthcare shortages. And now we're going to focus on another area facing pressure because of COVID, and that is the trucking industry. In the early days of the pandemic, getting across the U.S.-Canada border wasn't easy unless you were a long-haul truck driver moving essential things like food and electronics. And now, starting Saturday, Canada will require all truckers, including Canadians, to show proof of vaccination in order to cross over from the U.S. Marketplace's Savannah Marr explains what that could mean for supply chains.
Most employees of Hanson Trucking in Northwest Montana are ready for the looming mandate.
90% of our drivers that go to Canada are vaccinated. Some of them are under protest doing that, but they've still done it.
Manager Steve Hanson says he has work for the holdouts. Only about 60% of the company's routes are international. The problem, he says, is attracting new workers willing to get vaccinated.
Very much so. It's a deal breaker when you mention that COVID shot.
The trucking workforce is shrinking on both sides of the border, says Stephen Leskowski with the Canadian Trucking Alliance.
During COVID and with the great resignation factors, there are many who chose early retirement.
He says replacing those retirees has been challenging in today's tight labor market. And once the mandate goes into effect, he predicts the industry will have 12,000 more jobs to fill in Canada alone.
That's why we suggested to push this mandate out into the future when the supply chain is far more stable.
Further disruptions could depend on whether trucking companies have been preparing for this rule change. According to Johnny Rungtasunatham, a professor of supply chain management at York University in Toronto.
If so, then plans would have been put in place so that any pain that we will feel will be short-lived. And that's the best case scenario.
But if companies haven't lined up enough vaccinated drivers,
we're going to save more delays and we're going to see, you know, cost increases.
According to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, trade in goods between both countries totaled about $612 billion in 2019, before the pandemic. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up,
this is the final frontier.
Oh, sounds dramatic. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones fell 162 points, 0.4%, to close at 36,068. The Nasdaq gained 6 points, up just a tad, to end at 14,942. And the S&P 500 shed 6 points, 0.1%, to finish at 4670. Andy Euler was telling us how banks might be affected by the prospect of higher interest rates. Today, JPMorgan Chase dashed up 0.1%. Citigroup added 0.3%. Wells Fargo up 1%. And something else that Jay Powell will be asked about tomorrow? Inflation. A new survey from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York showed consumers' worries about rising prices remained at record highs last month. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. We're going to turn our attention to climate change for a bit. There's news out today that greenhouse gas emissions rose 6% last year after a record decline in 2020. That's according to a preliminary estimate by the Rhodium Group. A lot of that was fueled by a rise in coal power and truck traffic as the economy bounced back. But the thing is, a good amount of emissions come from us, from our homes. I'm talking about the natural gas we use when we throw our clothes in the dryer or bake a cake or cook fettuccine Alfredo pasta. That kind of household energy accounts for 20% of emissions in this country. That's according to a National Academy of Sciences study. Meanwhile, housing these days is in short supply, nearly 4 million units short, according to Freddie Mac. So the question is, how do you build more houses without adding to the climate crisis? Matt Hoisch from KOTO in Telluride, Colorado, explains.
A crew is building homes on a hillside along a road in western Colorado. The spot will soon have 30 new, affordable housing units. Delaney Young looks on from outside the construction area.
It's so satisfying to see this take shape.
Young is the mayor of Telluride, Colorado. The town, along with the local county, is developing the housing called Sunnyside, in part a reference to the abundant sunlight the south-facing hillside gets, also a nod to the rooftop solar that will make these homes net zero for carbon emissions.
We knew it would cost more money in the initial stages to do it in this manner, but it would have been irresponsible of us to not consider this simply because of its geographical location.
Telluride is an expensive place to live, with houses in the mountain resort town selling at about $2 million on average last year, according to Telluride Consulting, a local real estate analysis company. Sunnyside will offer rentals at below market rates for the workers supporting that resort economy. Lance McDonald, the town's program director, estimates development costs increased by about 6% to completely offset its greenhouse gas emissions, reaching net zero year over year.
Which means that the project will be generating the same amount of energy that it would use on an annual basis.
Essentially, the housing is still connected to the grid, but it also supplies energy from its solar panels. Given the housing shortage in the U.S. and the global climate crisis, net zero affordable housing sounds appealing. But how likely is it to take off more widely?
You don't necessarily save money by reducing carbon.
Kim Vermeer is a green building and sustainability consultant. Affordable housing, she says, actually uses green building practices more than market rate housing. in part because developers recognize they can reduce long-term operating costs by making the buildings energy efficient. But reducing carbon emissions can also sometimes come at a cost.
There is something of a disconnect, and especially when the push to decarbonize pushes us to electrify.
Replacing gas systems with electric ones, like heating and hot water, can help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But in a lot of places, electricity costs more than gas. Lauren Bauman is the vice president at New Ecology, a nonprofit focused on sustainable development in low-income communities.
The last thing we want to do is burden affordable housing developers and owners and tenants with utility costs that they can't afford.
Ideally, Bauman says, adding renewable energy, like solar, can compensate for those higher costs. But sometimes, she says, that's not an option, either because developers don't have the money or the site doesn't get enough sunlight. Still, even without renewables, energy-efficient homes, Bauman adds, can help with higher costs. And they can help people adapt to climate change. That's especially important for low-income communities.
There's been a lot of research that's been done to show low-income populations just don't have as many options when it comes to dealing with these severe weather impacts. And so having the ability for their housing to stay habitable in the face of some of this extreme weather and climate challenge is also a really important piece.
Back in Telluride, Mayor Young says she hopes other communities can look to Sunnyside as inspiration for their own projects.
We want to all work together to not have to reinvent the wheel. If we have a project that works, if we have an idea that works, we want other people to be able to replicate it.
Sunnyside is set to open by summer 2022, just in time for sunny skies. In Telluride, I'm Matt Hoisch for Marketplace.
Okay, so now we're going to turn to a larger issue within this topic, which is how we actually develop energy. In this fight against climate change, many countries are trying to curb carbon emissions and come up with alternatives to fossil fuels. And one technology is nuclear fusion, which, as the name implies, fuses nuclear atoms instead of splitting them. It releases enormous amounts of energy and produces temperatures hotter than the sun. For decades, scientists have tried to get safe, unlimited, cheap, and carbon-free energy from nuclear fusion. And now, with the topic of climate change hotter than ever, yes, that was a pun, private projects have multiplied and investment money is pouring in. Marketplace's Stephen Beard paid a visit to one fusion project in southeast England.
I was rather hoping I'd have to don a hazmat suit with Perspex visor to get into this facility, but Kevin Buick, the company's health and safety officer, put me right.
We are a fusion site, so it's exciting stuff that we talk about here, but actually we have very standard hazards.
And so I wore the standard issue for an industrial facility, hard hat, steel toe cap, boots and high-vis jacket. But there's nothing standard about the ambition powering this project.
This is the final frontier. The endgame solution for all time for humankind.
Tokamak Energy's CEO, Chris Kelsall.
We're producing a reliable, safe, clean source of decarbonized energy. It's going to be such an exciting journey that, in fact, has no limits.
The journey sounds dangerous, though. The technology at work here is pretty fearsome. Inside a tokamak, a large steel chamber containing powerful magnets, hydrogen atoms are forced to fuse at incredibly high temperatures.
Our next milestone is 100 million degrees centigrade.
That's 212 million degrees Fahrenheit. Graham Dunbar, project manager of this reactor, the ST40, insists that it's perfectly safe.
Nevertheless, those sorts of temperatures sound pretty scary.
They are contained within the magnetic field. So the outside of ST40 does not get hot. You can put your hand on the outside of ST40.
Unlike with nuclear fission, the radiation emitted by fusion dissipates in about 20 minutes, so no problem with nuclear waste. And there's no potentially uncontrollable chain reaction.
So no possibility of meltdown?
There isn't, no. It's inherently safe.
and potentially cheap, since the fuel, hydrogen, is the 10th most abundant element on Earth, and the fusion process releases 4 times as much energy as fission. Tokamak's boss, Chris Kelsall, hopes to be selling commercial devices within a couple of decades.
We're seeking to develop fusion power plants for global deployment in the late 2030s and early 2040s.
But fusion research projects are underway around the world and have been for half a century. So far, they've all produced less energy than it took to cause the fusion in the first place. Steve Thomas, a retired professor from Greenwich University, is a fusion skeptic.
It's always been just over the horizon, and 50 years on, that's where it still seems to be.
The mantra has always been the same, he says. In another 10 years or so, we'll have a commercial device.
Maybe that will be the case this time around, but I'm sceptical after so many broken promises over the past 50 or so years.
Back at Tokamak Energy, they're undeterred. Just follow the money, says Chris Kelsall. Private investors have poured more than $160 million into his company and more than $1 billion into rival American projects.
Investors are realising that fusion needs to be looked at, it needs to be investigated, and if they don't have a seat at the table, there's a very real risk that they're going to miss out on the next Google.
An international race is underway to make fusion pay, and this company believes it has every chance of winning it. In Didcot, Oxfordshire, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. If you take a look at Google search trends, you can see that people Googling COVID test near me has increased 4 times over the last month. And people asking, where can I buy an at-home COVID test, has increased almost 3,000%. And then lastly, people asking, where can I play Wordle, increased more than 4,000% in the last week. I can confirm that I have Googled all 3 of those things. Actually, just Googled the Wordle question last night and then proceeded to spend an hour playing different iterations of the game. And I am definitely going to play it after this show. All right, we've got to go, but not before your moment of economic context. It's going to be a short one today. Going off that final note, today the Biden administration announced that health insurers will be required to cover the cost of up to 8 at-home COVID testing kits a month. That starts this Saturday. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Rima Reis, and we'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.